satte deve gaurvani pacharane nirvishesha sunyavari postachade satarane omangyanam timbodam dasya gananjana shalakaya chaksur militam jainam tasmai sri gurave namaha. So I'm offering my obeisances unto His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, my spiritual master, who has so kindly opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge while I was standing in the midst of darkest ignorance. So it's very nice to be here. I want to thank all of you for coming. This is a little out of our normal territory, I think. Our temple is in the northwest lobe of Philadelphia, and they told me it took 2 hours to get here, but it only took an hour, so it's not so far away from where we are. We're just 5 miles off the Pennsylvania Turnpike, so we're not so hard to get to. So I hope to see more of you at our Radha Sharabihari Temple in Mount Airy in Philadelphia. So I thought I'd just introduce myself. My name is Ravindra Swarup Das. This was the name given to me in 1971 by my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, who came to this country in 1965. I'm just turned 50, so I just came into contact with the devotees when I was about 25 years old, so I guess about half my life now I've been a devotee of Krishna. And I thought, it says, the prayer I said, Om Mangyanam Timaram Dasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksur Militam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. That says that I was standing in darkness, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with gananjana. Anjana, you know, means like the ointment that you put in the eyes. Gananjana, the ointment of gyan, the ointment of knowledge. Shalakaya, with a shalaka. Shalaka means like a kind of a stick with a flat paddle end to use to put medicine to put something in the eye. So shalaka. So like I had a cataract or was blind, and like a eye doctor can put some medicine in and clear it up. So same way one's eyes have been opened by the spiritual master. So this happened to me when I was young. At that time, actually, I became a devotee. I was in religious studies in graduate school, third year of graduate school in religious studies. And I had taken maybe three courses already in Hinduism by people who knew their subject, actually. One of my teachers was actually, this was at Temple University in Philadelphia. I had begun my studies at University of Pennsylvania, undergraduate school, studying philosophy because I was one of these people looking for the truth. So I majored in philosophy as undergraduate and decided that I would look at religion since philosophy. Well, one professor said that success in philosophy is being clear about what you're confused about. So I thought that I would like to do better than that, so I decided to study religion. So I went to this religion department at Temple University where they had took Hinduism course. They had Swami Nikhilananda from the Ramakrishna Mission in New York used to teach us Hinduism. He commuted down from New York. He was in charge of the mission in New York. He's a disciple of Vivekananda. Then another Hinduism teacher was the widow of Surendranath Dasgupta. She and her husband together wrote the 5-volume History of Indian Philosophy. I had good Hinduism teachers that were pretty good. And then one day in my third year, I saw some Western people dressed like I am, with their head shaved, jumping up and down with a drum and chanting Hare Krishna. This was in 1969, I think. I saw them standing like that. And the first thing I thought was, you'll never catch me doing something like that. But then the second thing I thought was, when I saw the devotees, I immediately understood that something in the spiritual ecology of the world had changed. Because I remember as a child going to church with my parents, and we were giving donations to send missionaries to India. And we would every week give some money so that the Methodist and Baptist missionaries would go and convert the heathen Hindus. And all of a sudden, here I saw Western devotees who were chanting Hare Krishna. So I realized the missionary effort was now coming the other way. So something, some big, profound shift had happened somewhere out in the world, that now Western people could be becoming Krishna devotees. And so I was kind of interested as an academic student of religion. And then a few weeks later, and actually, quite frankly, I was engaged in religious studies, but I was also one of these people who was looking for salvation. In the course of studying religion, so I decided, well, I'm going to study religion, but why should I be limited to whatever religion I was brought up with? Here it is, it's the 20th century, it's one world, you can get on an airplane and be all over the world very fast. Why should I just study Christian religion? Let me look and see what's going on in Buddhist traditions, Hindu traditions, Islamic traditions. That's what I thought to do. So I had decided about the same time that I saw devotees that one essential truth and the highest part of all the religious traditions I had studied was said very nicely by Lord Buddha. He said, first of all, that material existence is suffering. Well, I agreed with that. I realize there are some people that never have that feeling. He used the word, Sanskrit word, dukkha. Material existence, life is dukkha. And I could see that myself. I could understand that everything in this material world is temporary. To order to achieve anything, you have to work very, very hard. And then whatever you achieve is taken away from you at the time of death. You form various attachments. You try to establish relationships by which you enjoy happiness. And these relationships are very difficult to maintain at the cost of great effort and anxiety. And ultimately, at the end, they're all broken at the time of death, which is our ultimate failure to perpetuate relationships. So I could see that actually there is no prospect for happiness in the material world. Unless, of course, I deluded myself, which many people do. A great deal of civilization is just engineering self-delusion. Right? So we don't have to look at the way things really are. Anyway, so I understood that material existence is suffering. And then Buddha said the cause of the suffering is our desires, our graspings, our cravings, our attachments. I can see that. And he said the cure is to become free from these desires. Okay, I agreed with that. But just try to do it. Huh? All right in theory, but what about practice? Huh? So all my attempts to become free from material desires, or even to control them, was not meeting with much success. And besides this, this was 1968, 69, and people were, at those times in America, the whole generation was going crazy for drugs and sex. It was the beginning of the hippie movement and so on. All my friends were going pretty far away and taking me with them. So So I was in that state of mind when I happened to see devotees agree, understanding what I actually should be doing and being unable to get anywhere. So anyways, a friend of mine came to me a week or two later and said, oh, there's this place you got to come to, this Krishna temple. And I said, oh, come on. They said, no, you got to come, it's really nice. There's a vegetarian feast. And for some reason or other, my wife and I had decided to become vegetarians. We didn't really have a philosophy about it, but it seemed to be cleaner and neater. So we were pretty much given up meat eating. And so anyway, I went to a Krishna temple. At that time, it was this little row house out behind the University of Pennsylvania that some devotees had just come down a few weeks earlier from New York City, where the movement had its start, and opened a temple in Philadelphia, two or three devotees. And so I wasn't really up for anything spiritual. And we walked into this, this was this little broken down, shabby, student housing. You know what student housing looks like. It was student housing. Shabby place, and walked into this little hall with stained and torn wallpaper, and suddenly I had this sensation of overwhelming splendor and beauty, and I was upset. I said, wow, where did that come from? And I got a little frightened because I didn't know what I wasn't up for any serious experience with the Hare Krishna devotees, you know. So anyway, everybody was in a crowded together in a room and all standing up and chanting Hare Krishna. So I got in, I chanted, and then there was a lecture. Next thing was a lecture. And most of the audience at that time were mostly young people, students, hippie types. The devotee who was giving the lecture was very stern. Actually, he was very forceful. He was almost, chastising his audience. And he was telling everybody that they had to stop taking all intoxicants, that LSD and marijuana, they won't save you. He was saying, we shouldn't take any intoxicants, not even coffee or tea. You should not eat meat or fish or eggs. You should be strictly vegetarian. That you should not engage in any illicit sex. Even in marriage, you should restrict sex for procreation of children. And he said you should not gamble or engage in various kinds of speculative enterprises. These are the four principles of freedom. It didn't sound like freedom to most people around me. Everybody was getting a little turned off. But I was thinking, someone's telling the truth. That's what I was thinking. For the first time, I was very impressed, because here was a devotee. I knew, I had been studying religious traditions. I heard what Lord Buddha had said. I'd heard what Swami Nikalananda had told me and everybody, that anyone who is serious about becoming a transcendentalist, about mukti, they have to become free from material desires. If we have material desires at the time of death, again we take birth in this world. And that's what I didn't want to do. So I thought, these are serious people when they have these principles like that. And they weren't trying to win some cheap acceptance from a group of people who were, they weren't flattering their audience at all. The audience, people were ready to walk out when they heard these things. What? No intoxication? In 1969, people were thinking that the whole world would be saved if everyone just took LSD. And I'm serious. So the devotee explained at that time that it's not possible to control the senses. simply by trying to give up things. If you just try to take your senses and disengage them from the sense objects, you'll have nothing to do, the mind will go crazy, and again you'll become attached. He told us that what you have to do is give your senses spiritual engagement. Not just disengage from matter, but connect your senses positively with transcendence. Now, at the time I didn't know it, but this actually, according to Narada Pancharatra, is the definition of bhakti. And the Narada Pancharatra says, Rishikesha Rishikenam Sevanam Bhakti Ruchate. Bhakti is called, means engaging the senses in the service of Rishikesh, which means master of the senses. Engaging the senses in the service of the master of the senses. So the devotee said, if you engage your senses positively in acts of devotion, then you will lose your taste for material sensual activities. I didn't know if it was true or not, but it sounded reasonable. It's one thing to be reasonable, it's another thing to be true, but at least reasonableness is the beginning. And then the devotee went on to tell us that the control of the senses begins with the tongue. The tongue has two activities. Later I learned that according to the Sankhya classification, the tongue is both Gyanindriya and Karmindriya. It's an instrument for receiving knowledge, and it's an instrument for performing activities. So as a Gyanindriya, the function of the tongue is to taste. And as a Karmindriya, the function of the tongue is to produce sound. And so it has this double function of tasting and producing sound. So, you can try to become free from material desires. And, for example, sages take a vow of silence. In fact, the vow of silence is called mona. That's something that munis do, is they remain silent. They do not speak anything material. But that's very hard to do. And then the mind will go jabber, 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 jabber. So he said, what we have to do is chant the Hare Krishna mantra. This is a sound vibration that, he said, does not come from this material world. It's Shabda Brahman. It's transcendental sound. And by engaging our senses, our tongue, by chanting Hare Krishna, we come into contact with the Supreme Brahman. Krishna is called in Bhagavad Gita, Param Brahman. He's the Supreme Brahman. And that way, our tongue has positive spiritual activity. It becomes purified. And then we gradually lose our taste for talking about so many nonsense things. What is Michael Jackson doing? What is O.J. Simpson doing? Whatever the latest hot topics of conversation. So that was one thing they suggested, chanting Hare Krishna. And the other thing they said was, you have to eat only Krishna prasad, food that has been offered to Krishna. When you take something material like food stuff, if you prepare it for Krishna with love and offer it to him in devotion, then you can take the remnant prasad. And if you eat Krishna prasad, you'll lose your taste for McDonald's hamburgers and everything else. So at that point, there was an experiential dimension. He said, if you do these things, certain things will happen. I was ready to experiment. I thought, let me try. So I got one set of japa beads. They had them there, just like these beads here, japa beads. I got a set of japa beads, and I thought I would do an experiment. Now, I didn't know whether he said was true or not. I didn't even know who these people were, for sure. But in those days and age, people were taking very powerful drugs on the plea of finding spiritual experience. This seemed rather harmless. So I got some japa beads, and I sat down and went, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, so on. I don't know how much, maybe half an hour a day, something like that. And on the right then and there, right after the lecture, they served us out a big feast, so I had an idea what that was like. The first time in my life I ever had rasgullas. And that certainly tasted spiritual. It still does, yeah. I never had anything like it. You put this ball in your mouth and you bite down and then sweet taste floods out. So, my Guru Maharaj used to call rasgullas ISKCON bullets. So I got shot. So when I began, I went home and I began chanting, and then my material desires began to go away. I began to happen. It's not that I saw lights or things like that, but I perceived that lust and greed and anger began to disappear from my heart, actually very quickly. And then I got frightened. I realized this is something very powerful, and I don't really know who these people are or what this business is or what I'm getting into. I didn't know any of these things. At that time, 1969, hardly anyone had even heard of the Hare Krishna movement. It had only started really a few years earlier in this country. And so, I stopped chanting because I was a little frightened. It seemed so powerful a thing to do. Even though in one way it was doing what I wanted, still I didn't know. But very quickly I began to feel very bad. And all these desires came rushing back. I felt like a big cloud of grease had come over me. So I began chanting after maybe a week or so. I started chanting again. But I said, I have to find out what these people are about, where they're going. So far, I'd only seen them jumping up and down and chanting and so on. And actually, you know, I was an intellectual. I mean, I was studying so many things in graduate school. I was thinking of writing a doctoral dissertation comparing Sripad Shankaracharya with Hegel and all these other things. And I really did not think that the Krishna devotees, they had much philosophy. Because people you see standing on the street corners chanting, you think they're kind of fanatic, or maybe low-class people, just making a public display of emotions. It seems like not quite right. At least to intellectual people, I think there's something a little excessive about it. Enthusiasm. You know, in 18th century England, enthusiasm was a very bad word. That time the devotees did not have very many books, actually, but I managed to get one book, which was a translation and commentary by Srila Prabhupada on the Isha Upanishad. Now, I had studied Isha Upanishad before in my Hinduism classes, and nobody knew what it meant. The translator said, these are very obscure lines, and none of my teachers could explain it very well. It was very mystical, and I guess because you couldn't understand it, we thought that meant it was very profound. So I read Prabhupada's translation and commentary on the Isha Upanishad. It's very, very simple language. But by the time I finished, I was overwhelmed. I was a critical thinker. My field was philosophical theology. And for the first time I read Prabhupada's commentary, I realized I was in the presence of a really first-class job of theology. And I was very surprised. I mean, here were these Hare Krishna people dancing on the streets, and then the book they give me, which is in very simple language, is yet very profound. I read it 2 or 3 times. And I underwent a kind of revolution in my head just from thinking about this Krishna conscious philosophy. And when I went and talked to the devotees at the temple, and most of them, they were not that well educated. And they were speaking things, repeating the philosophy they had heard, and they didn't understand even what they were saying. They didn't see all the implications that I saw because I had some professional training in this field. And so slowly I became convinced that the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, philosophy of Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, it was actually